Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today's Beyond the Darkness is brought to you by Bombas Socks. We all love to refresh our snack drawers, but when's the last time you refreshed your sock drawer? Well, if you can't remember, probably time for an upgrade, huh? Bombas Socks are made with comfort innovations like arch support, a seamless toe, and a cushioned footbed. All socks speak for super comfortable. They all come in hundreds of colors and styles, making them perfect for men, women, and kids. Let me tell you about Bombas socks. First of all, folks, I had a bunch of diabetic socks in my sock drawer. I've practically gotten rid of almost all of them, and right now, I have plenty of Bombas socks. They're soft, they're comfortable, they don't bunch up real hard around the ankles and leave marks in my little delicate diabetic ankles and feet. They're absolutely perfect. I tell you, I recommend Bombas to everyone who has diabetic foot issues and foot problems. Bombas are perfect for diabetic feet. Bombas has a new line of merino wool socks that are made from soft, warm, and naturally moisture-wicking merino wool, designed with all the Bombas classic comfort features. From cool and dry on your morning run to staying comfortable in your office's freezing air conditioning, Bombas socks are ready to work as hard as you do. And for every pair of socks you buy, this is the great part. And this is why Beyond the Darkness likes to support Bombas. Bombas will donate a pair for someone in need. Bombas are what your feet daydream about. I know my feet daydream about it. Simply buy your Bombas at bombas.com/darkness today. And here's the great thing. You get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/darkness. And you'll get 20% off. bombas.com/darkness. Get 20% off. Do it today. Welcome into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness for a Sunday. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader, who is in, I don't think it's jolly old France, but it's France nonetheless. And if you want to join us around the world for any paranormal trips, anywhere we're going around the world to explore the strange and unusual, you can go to darknessevents.com. Now, Dave and I will both be in Chicago, October 18th through the 20th for Chicago Ghost Conference. And that's going to be strange and unusual on its own. Not only will we have your usual suspects of speakers that'll be talking about the paranormal, but we're also featuring wrestling this year. Go figure. And of all things strange and unusual, Chicago Ghost Conference. You can click the link at darknessevents.com and you can check it out there. And check us out in October in Chicago. In January, even more unusual, but even more fun. Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager Part Deux. It's the second wave. It sets sail on the high seas. I'm never good at sailing the seas lingo, as it were. But we head off from Miami to the Bahamas for 5 days and sail right through the Bermuda Triangle. As Dave and I are your paranormal experts, that's kind of a oxymoron, as it were. But we sail the high seas from Miami to the Bahamas. That's in January. And you can get your details right there at darknessevents.com. Click on the link there. I think there's less than 10 cabins available for this thing. You got to check out the guest list. It's amazing. AEW Wrestling is the wrestling that's actually on board. There's actually live wrestling on a cruise ship if you've never been on this cruise before. Plenty of rock bands to entertain you as well, podcasts galore, and your special guest host for the cruise is Fluffy himself, Gabriel Iglesias. Go figure. Lots of great stuff. Of course, you get plenty of Chris Jericho in the ring. You get plenty of Chris Jericho on stage with Fozzy. It's a great time. And of course, you get the King of Drip himself. You've got Ric Flair on board. You got to love that. It's all on that cruise. ChrisJerichoCruise.com or just go through darknessevents.com and book your cabin. There's less than 10 available. I don't know what you're waiting for. If you've been waiting this long, you're almost out of luck. But check those two events out as well. That's where you can see Dave and I for the rest of 2019 into 2020. Let's get to our guest, shall we? We've got an interesting program. You know, we like to play the game What If every once in a while here on Beyond the Darkness and talk about what if certain things happened in the world, as it were, and certain scenarios around the world. And today we're going to play a little What If with our guest, Mike Pearl. Mike Pearl is a columnist for Vice Magazine, and he has a book out called The Day It Finally Happened, or the Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomenon. Let's welcome into Beyond the Darkness, Mike Pearl. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tim. How's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
It's going great. It's going great. You know, so we like to play the speculation game around here at Beyond the Darkness quite a bit, and we like to play What If quite a bit. And I've seen a lot of things in my day. I sound like an old prospector here, Mike, but I'm not as young as I may sound on the air here. But I have seen a lot of things, even in the last 10, 15 years that have surprised me. And even on the world stage, when it comes to, things like, I don't know that I'd even say the political front, but even on the political front, I've seen some things that are bizarre. You know, when you talk about, you could talk about anything from President Obama going after Osama bin Laden, a president going after a terrorist head and taking him out, to even the surprise of President Trump being elected. That, I mean, stuff like that is shocking. I mean, you know, a president being elected to a nation that has no governmental experience.
yeah. I mean, things do seem to have taken a turn for the more sort of like, cinematic. They seem to be things that seem to be from a movie or TV show seem to, you know, happen in real life these days. And I actually wrote, way back in 2015, one of the things that sort of set me on this course of writing What If articles and now this book was when I wrote a series of articles, one about what would happen if Bernie Sanders were president. This I wrote in 2015, mind you. Okay. and one on what would happen if Trump were president, that were seen as quite outlandish. Mm-hmm. and that's certainly changed now. I don't think people see those things as quite so outlandish. And the funny thing about that, that Trump article way back in the day, the one that, you know, completely came true, was that the historian that I spoke to, Brian Ballow, was, you know, he made a prediction that certainly came true in my case for the Trump presidency, which was, he said, what seems exciting now in the midst of a Trump presidency is going to get pretty boring, and people are going to kind of want to cancel it like a TV show. And I, you know what? In my case, that has definitely come true. I'm kind of bored with it, actually.
You know, you do raise a good point, and that is there a certain amount of fatigue? I would think on both sides of the aisle. I think, is there fatigue on the left? Are we tired of hearing the same stuff over and over again? And on the right, are we tired of hearing complaints about the same stuff over and over again? You know, are we getting tired of... pardon my language, but I'm going to throw it out there. Are we tired of each other's shit now?
I mean, it does seem like we are. It does seem like we are. And it's and the business that I'm not in is the one where you sort of like follow the horse race of politics. But yeah. You know, people are definitely tired of each other's shit. And so, you know, I'll be watching for what kind of far off what ifs in politics are coming next. It's going to be something a lot crazier, I think, than what we've got. We've gotten the current political scene.
Well, that's what's scary. You know, we're on the precipice of another presidential election. And I'll be honest with you, Mike. I mean, we're not really a political show. We're, you know, a paranormal, metaphysical, you know, type show. But we love to play the what if game. And when you talk conspiracies, and we can definitely talk conspiracies with this, that would be you know, you're talking about setting yourself up for something coming out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the field of candidates right now, you know, that the Democrats are pitching, there's not really one that stands out. I mean, not really one that's at least to me that says, you know, that's going to grab somebody by the throat and lead that field. At least to me, there's not. There's a few that I look at and I go, you know, that could potentially be the front runner. But if you look at who are you going to put against this candidate who seems to have a stronghold on his party right now, you know, you're talking about do the Democrats throw a curveball in there that potentially, you know, just as wild a curveball as the right threw in with Donald Trump. And maybe you do get some bizarre candidate out of left field and we just have. All right, I'll swear again and throw in a shit show, you know.
You know, I think what you describe as a shit show is just kind of the winds of change. I think in all ways, politics have just completely, you know, have really drastically have gone in a really drastic direction, and I think that with this election, you know. Again, I'm not a political writer. I'm not a horse race writer, but right. I do, you know, but I watch these trends and it does seem to me like there's a lot of a desire for, things to go quote unquote back to normal for kind of the toothpaste to get put back in the tube, but toothpaste just doesn't go back in tubes, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, my prediction is that it's never going to be normal again. It's never going to feel normal again. We never get to wake up and feel the way that we used to feel watching the news. It's just for the rest of our lives going to have, you know, as they say, a bit of a different vibe from now on.
That's unfortunate. I want to bring up a topic with you that Dave and I we have this running bet on the show. We've had it on the show for many, many years, and I think you'll be entertained by this, Mike. We've ever since, you know, the quote unquote, you're going to laugh at this, the quote unquote zombie outbreak, you know, with bath salts, when bath salts were the thing and
right.
People were trying to eat each other. And Dave called the zombie outbreak. I laughed at that. And then, of course, I'm of the belief that technology or Skynet will take over eventually one day. So we have this running bet over a box of Twinkies because we figured it should be something rather trivial that we're betting over. And we both love Twinkies. So I've got the bet that eventually machinery will take over. He has the bet that eventually the zombie virus or bath salts will take over and we'll all be munching on each other. And that's how the world will end. And it'll happen sooner than later. Okay. And we've kept this charade up for years, with our audience. And in that there is some very real elements, at least to the technology side of things. It seems like every day there's a story coming out about technology gone wrong. You know, you have robots at Amazon that accidentally get into the bear spray.
I hadn't heard that one.
You hadn't heard that one?
No, I had not.
There was an Amazon, warehouse where they were, it was an automated robot that had accidentally punctured, a giant canister of bear spray. And it had caused a giant leak in an Amazon warehouse.
Oh boy.
Yeah, you know, there's stuff like that. You have videos that are appearing on social media about these robots that can do amazing things. You know, and you just see things that people just tag with Skynet, you know, it's the coming of Skynet.
right.
You see technology, you know, you're carrying around a cell phone or an iPhone that has more memory in it than anything we shot up into space during the moon landing. So let me throw this at you, Mike, and I'll let you expound on it. When it comes to basic technology, when it comes to computers, when it comes to IT, What is your worst case scenario in your mind when it comes to this?
You know, it's my worst case scenario when it comes to technology right now is that it's taken away from me. I'm so completely reliant on it. People have asked me what in the book The Day It Finally Happens is my, you know, what chapter is there, a chapter that I would like to experience something that may sound dark, but I would actually like to see it happen. And there's a chapter in there on the internet going down, mm-hmm. and how that might play out. And as terrified as I know I would be to lose the internet, I kind of also want it to happen.
Okay.
If that makes sense, because I simply am so, I know I'd be lost without it. I can't imagine my life without the internet. There's this like part of me that desires that chaos. This part of me that's like, well, then flip the switch. Let's see what happens, you know, if that day finally came. Can I go back to something you were saying about, you were talking about zombies and, sure. And the singularity.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love those topics and I like that you have been, thinking about those in terms like that. Mm-hmm. So the way that I write predictions, doesn't allow me to kind of talk about things like zombies or Skynet or something like that, because I'm trying to talk to people who have, you know, experienced these things, talk to experts who've studied these similar events through history and approach them in a somewhat more realistic way.
Okay.
But I've come to realize I should have done a chapter. I say in the intro I'm not going to do a chapter on zombies.
Okay.
But I kind of wish I had done a chapter on zombies.
Okay.
in the book, because, you know, that's a really good example of what I do. You can look at something like zombies and you can think of it as an epidemic, right? If there's a zombie outbreak, then it's a disease.
Okay.
And so this is sort of how I write the book. I sort of like conceptualize it using things that conceptualize something that maybe doesn't exist using things that do.
Okay.
And so if you have a zombie outbreak, then you have people catching some kind of plague, something that maybe spreads like Ebola.
Okay.
Spreading. It seems like it spreads via blood. It spreads by those viruses usually spread by like a bite.
Mm-hmm.
So then it would maybe something that would be contagious in a way similar to Ebola, and it would have a mechanism of onset. Maybe similar to rabies. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Something similar to that. Sure.
Makes people aggressive, makes people attack one another. And so, you know, as I write these chapters, I would go to people who've been maybe attacked and bitten. So a chapter in my book on zombies would interview somebody who's been bitten by another person, or maybe somebody who's been attacked by a chimp. Because a chimp attack would be, I think, kind of similar to a zombie attack, you know. So then I would want to know what that's like to, you know, to feel teeth, you know, cutting into your skin. Like, what do you feel?
Ooh,
and I would
yeah.
want to talk to an epidemiologist who was there on the ground during Ebola, who could tell me, you know, what it's like for people to have to shun their neighbors because they're infected, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so these things. So a zombie outbreak in the abstract, you know, sounds almost kind of fun. But when you think about having your skin ripped off by an attack, somebody who's biting you, or you think about your neighbors being consumed by this horrible disease and you having to shun them and keep them away from your family, you know, then it becomes much more visceral. It sort of stops being a game. If that makes sense. So anyway, so I was glad you brought that up because it gave me a chance to kind of like talk about how I write these chapters.
Sure. Well, why, and let me ask you this, why did you not go to that extreme? Was it because it didn't fit in with the criteria or because it was a little bit of a stretch?
It was because it's too much of a stretch. I think the way that I write these chapters, if I said zombie outbreak, I'd be speaking about it very literally.
Oh, okay.
And talking about it in practical terms. And since, you know, zombies are really at their core, they're this like Caribbean myth that comes from the voodoo religion, I gather, and some kind of drug that's used to control people, which I'm not sure works the way the legend says that it does. Zombies are essentially not real enough to qualify for a chapter. Otherwise, I definitely would have done it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Understandable. Now we may be splitting hairs here. Because you do have skeptics out there, especially in the paranormal world, who would say, okay, zombies, you say, not necessarily real enough, but you do have things in your book like alien contact and dinosaurs and things that, although you claim, okay, could be real, how do you prove aliens are out there and real, yet zombies aren't?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be a fair hair to split. I guess a lot of it comes down to my own judgment, you know, but in the case of extraterrestrials, it's just mass, you know. There's just you can kind of crunch your own numbers. I sort of like crunch the numbers on exactly how many. I think what I did to deduce that aliens are, you know, probably real, but there's a pretty good chance we'll never actually encounter them. I figured out that you'd have to imagine every potentially habitable planet as a grain of rice, and so if each one of those is a grain of rice, then you would have to individually inspect every grain of rice in, I think it was 800,000 bags, 800,000 20-pound bags of rice. So you'd have to spend many, many, many lifetimes individually inspecting each of these grains of rice in order to confirm that there absolutely were no extraterrestrials. And the conclusion that I basically came from, you know, from doing that kind of like bizarre thought experiment was, well, one way or another, those intelligent extraterrestrials are, I don't know, probably out there, even if they never call us on the phone, you know?
Understandable. I want to talk to you a little bit about alien contact and what kind of information you dug up on it in just a moment. But first, 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. And you know what else exactly you can do in about a minute? Well, you can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, maybe even contact an alien or two, or just listen to the sound of my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or your home. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get your answers that you need so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis, filling in for Dave Schrader, who is across the pond, I guess. That's a pretty big pond. And we are in today and talking to Mike Pearl, whose book is out there and available right now. It's called The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomena. It's available right now on Amazon.com. Mike, do you have a website that you wanted to put out there as well?
Sure. You can check me out at MikeLeePearl.com or just find me at Mike Lee Pearl on Twitter.
All right, cool. So we're talking about alien contact. Now, in the book, as you even pointed out yourself, you like to put it in a bit of reality and go to sources and find out exactly what it was that they encountered or what it was like to actually have alien contact. Who did you encounter that had this type of contact?
Well, I didn't go with anybody who's had, you know, close encounters of the third kind. for my chapter in the book, because the approach that I instead decided to take was maybe a little bit more of a disappointing scenario, because I'm supposing, for the purposes of this book, that the aliens contact us by accident. I think that's probably a little bit more likely. Okay. The folks at Berkeley that I spoke to, Dan Wertheimer of the SETI Institute at Berkeley, mm-hmm. and also Chris Impey, the British astronomer who works at the University of Arizona, that was kind of what they steered me toward. That was what they said in the SETI field they sort of like anticipate most of all would be the likely outcome, I'm afraid to say.
So that they just kind of happen upon us by accident, and we happen to get the crap scared out of us, is how this
yeah,
happens.
Exactly. So, you know, what they imagine is, or what they anticipate is that we will encounter a pulse of light, for instance,
okay.
or maybe a radio signal, maybe a pulse of light, maybe just a shadow that covers a star or something. And what we will discover is that this pattern that is maybe, you know, 100,000 light years out there is just simply too perfect to be organic, or maybe we're able to figure out that it's a language. We can't decode the language. It's a Fibonacci sequence. It's a bunch of prime numbers all in a row. It's a bunch of pulses that describe prime numbers all in a row. And then we spend ages trying to determine, did we send something out there? Is that our own technology that we're accidentally intercepting here? And then finally we make the determination that no, it looks like there's a star out there. The star has a planet. We think maybe there's something out there. There's some piece of infrastructure that is beaming a signal accidentally to our planet, and we just picked it up, and now we know that there's something out there. And the sad part is that if the signal really is that far away, maybe those aliens are dead by the time we're seeing this, you know, this evidence of their existence.
Hmm.
You know, what they told me was, if you want to contact a species that is that far out into the far flung corners of the universe, that you have to, you know, if we receive the signal, if we say hello back, then we have to wait hundreds of generations before we find out what happened when we sent that signal back. And, you know, and then if we're going to get a third reply from those aliens, then we have to wait hundreds of generations again to receive that reply. So it's this sort of like multi-generational, this sort of knowledge that they're there, this knowledge that we're not alone, but you know, what do we do with that knowledge? There's not much to be done with it, unless they send us some information, which is, you know, which is possible too. Who knows?
Right. Have they said that they believe that they're already in possession of some sort of message, that they maybe haven't decoded it yet, or that they think they may be onto something already?
Well, no, I don't think they said it had happened yet, but they have had similar. A few years ago, there was that darkening in one corner of the night sky that people thought might be a quote unquote a piece of alien infrastructure. It turned out to just be some natural phenomenon. But they did say that it would probably be kind of like that. Hmm. You know, the actual contact would kind of be like that. And that's why what I did in the book was I gave us Twitter on the day that the alien contact gets confirmed, you know, that the peer-reviewed paper that says, oh, we've confirmed it, these are aliens. I gave us, what is it like to open up Twitter and just start reading everybody's thoughts at the moment that everybody finds out that aliens are real, confirmed, no question about it. What's it like when that day finally comes? And as I described Twitter on that day, and you have to read the book to sort of like find out what it's like.
Sure.
It's not too different from Twitter. It's not too different from the Twitter that already exists, basically.
So you're of a mind that people can pretty much handle it.
I wouldn't say that.
No. Okay.
I think people who can handle it can handle it, and people who can't handle it are people who can't handle people who already can't handle the news on a day-to-day basis. Probably couldn't handle that news either.
See, I'm more of a mind of I don't think the majority of people can handle it. You already see, Mike, what the world is like already.
Sure.
You know, and people, enough people already have enough of a hair trigger on them we're not as much of an evolved species as we like to think we are, you know?
Right. Right.
And, mob rule is a real scary thing. It really is. And, when people get together in groups, strange things happen. And I would just think, I don't know, not like I'm speaking for any imaginary species out there, but if you ever wonder why you don't see as many flying saucers landing on your front lawn and saying hi, there's probably a reason for that.
You know? Yeah, I do wonder sometimes if there are flying saucers out there. I think there are a lot of people who say, well, they are out there, but the government won't let you know about them. And what that always makes me ask is, why are the aliens cooperating with the government? Sure, the government maybe doesn't want me to know about the aliens, but does the government completely control whether the aliens can make themselves known to me? if they want to show up, they'll show up. So yeah, I'm kind of with you. If they are out there and if they know about us, then maybe they just don't want to have anything to do with us.
Well, I always thought of it this way, and I don't know that very many people ever thought of it this way, in that, the government forms civil contracts with other governments on this planet. Why wouldn't they form a civil contract with a government of another planet?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And so they've already made an agreement to give away our like thought signals and we don't even know about it. There's already maybe like a treaty between the Earth government and the alien government.
Sure. Why not? I mean, if there's something that we have of use for them, I'm sure they have some sort of technology that's been of use to us. I mean, if there's some sort of trade available that we could trade with them and they could trade with us, why not do it and keep it civil? And because I'm sure the government knows, or many governments on this planet know. I think there's more than one. If this is the way things had to set up, I'm not saying this is the way it is, or that I think that this is the way it is. But if an alien civilization came here, I think that governments are level-headed enough. I know people are laughing as they hear me say this. That when it,
hey, I'm not laughing.
When it, as you chuckle, but there's I think there. When it comes to negotiation or seeing the value in trade among civilizations, they're seeing the value in, we don't have to like this group of people. We don't have to necessarily respect this group of people, but they have something we want. So we can negotiate with them, get what we want from them. They'll give us what we want. We'll give them what they want. And we can leave them in relative peace, especially if they have more firepower than we have.
yeah.
Whereas as individuals, if you have mob rule running around and they see somebody that looks stranger than they do, the first instinct is, I have to defend my tribe. So they may take a shot at an alien as opposed to walking up to it and saying, we come in peace, So I think that's where the government is saying, we're going to protect our citizenry by simply denying that it's out there and just saying, no, there's nothing out there. You're mistaken when you see an alien, because we're protecting mob rule from doing something that might hurt themselves. But at the same time, we're going to use this treaty that we've developed for the good of our people. So, for example, that little cell phone that you're using, or even the Skype line that we're using to talk to each other now, might have been developed from alien technology. You never know.
You never know.
But yeah. if it was developed off that technology, then we all benefited from something that the government did by using that power of treaty between two civilizations. And in the same time, we were all blissfully unaware that they made that treaty.
I like, you know, what you're the thing that you're talking about, sort of that our telecommunications maybe come from alien technology. It reminds me of, Britain wanting to trade opium with China, you know, where it's like this was something that seemed beneficial for them at the time. The merchants definitely wanted to sell people opium.
Yep.
People were willing to buy the opium, but then when the damage from the opium became clear and it was like, hey, maybe no more opium, then that was when the shit really hit the fan and you get the opium wars. I sometimes wonder if we're not there in terms of our telecommunications. Maybe we've had enough internet. Maybe we don't want any more of this damn internet, but we're kind of stuck with it.
Exactly. That's the thing. We've now interwoven artificial intelligence technology and everything into our daily lives to the point where maybe now we're starting to become slaves to the artificial intelligence into technology. And right. We've phased out a lot of the humanity in society. And now we're at that point, like you say, with the opium wars, where we're becoming a slave to the product.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do you do from there, you know?
Hopefully not fight a war with the aliens who have foisted this opium upon us.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's a big what-if scenario. But if that's truly what it is, then you know where the next step goes. That's just a what if, or I suppose, or you never know where this came from. Now, I tend to believe this, Mike. This is my belief. My belief is we don't give human beings enough credit for developing the technology in the first place.
Mm.
I really do believe that, whether you want to call it divine intervention, whether you want to call it, inspired creativity, whatever you want to call it. I believe there is a spark of humanity that is creative enough to come up with a lot of this.
Definitely. I completely agree with you. I look at a lot of this stuff, and as much as I criticize it and as much as a lot of it makes me uneasy, I really think it's amazing sometimes to look at the way that human ideas, many, many different, you were talking about, you know, divine inspiration. If you look at it as a, if you look at a smartphone as a constellation of other people's ideas, of many, many, many people's ideas, mm-hmm. you know, going back decades and decades and decades, and you look at how all those pieces of technology funneled in and in and in and in and in and turned into something like the iPhone, it is really amazing when you think of it that way. When you think about the many, many people whose ideas all turned into one object. Actually, my friend Brian Merchant wrote a book called The One Device about the many, many inventors of the iPhone. And I agree with you. I think it is astonishing. But I think of it as a piece of like mass project, a big cooperative project.
Right. Right. And the human mind really is, it's a beautiful thing. There's so many, you know, so many creative things that come out of it. And in the fact that there is the logical along with the creative that exists side by side with it and the things that it can do. It's a beautiful thing. It really is. And people don't give the human mind the credit that it deserves. You know, we think, well, there's just no way possible that can be done. It had to be aliens. why would you credit a species you don't even know exists over the fact that maybe this brilliant human mind came, or a consortium of human minds came up with this brilliant idea and made it reality?
Sure. Absolutely. You know?
Why is that so hard to believe?
Yeah, people see this dichotomy between logic and science and creativity as if they're two different things, you know. And it's like, well, you know, and speaking of contact with aliens, Carl Sagan is such a great example of somebody who had the science and the logic and the creativity, you know, all in one person. It's all right there. You know,
right.
You don't need aliens. You just need more people like that.
Exactly. Exactly. You've got that right. I'll tell you what, we'll take our halfway break here. And when we come back, let's continue with the discussion about humans, but let's talk about making them immortal. We'll do that when we come back. The name of the book is The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomena. The author is Mike Pearl. It's available right now at Amazon.com. We come back more with Mike Pearl, and we'll talk about how we can make ourselves immortal. It's coming up next on the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Tim, I'm not one of those kind of guys that likes to jump on most trends, right?
Right.
I avoided social media stuff like the plague for quite a while. I, you know, just a lot of the stuff I didn't do. My brother set up my Facebook account for me. You're the one that got me on MySpace. Thanks for that. You know, I think it took a while to get over onto the Twitter, and my kids got me eventually onto Instagram. And I'll tell you what, Tim, something has come to my attention that I've really thoroughly enjoyed, and it's called Best Fiends. Are you familiar with Best Fiends?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, if for our listeners, if you're looking for a fun way to pass the time while kind of stimulating your brain and enjoying breathtaking visuals and a really fun little story, your answer is Best Fiends. There is a character collection and these fun puzzles. And I've enjoyed it a lot because, first of all, it's just a lot of fun. It kind of combines elements of all of my favorite video games into one. And it does it in a really fun, evocative kind of way. There's a ton of different characters that you can collect and evolve. You can upgrade them. And as you continue to play, you're moving through this fantasy world trying to fix these puzzles. Think of so many different video games that you've liked, those elements that are perfect in their own little way, but they're all missing something. Well, Best Fiends has found a way to pull all of those best elements together in one casual game that anybody can play. But it is made for adults. With that said, my kids play it all the time, and now we sit around playing it together. They get a kick out of seeing how much further they can get past me and advance past me. The forerunner in our house, by the way, is my wife, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Winnie has kicked my ass time and time again. Every time I think I've made it to a great level, I'm on like level 68.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, yeah, I hit that a couple days ago. I'm on 89 right now. But my kids and I are always neck and neck, and we're playing along and having a lot of fun. And I've been playing it for a while. I enjoy playing it. I play it a couple times a day. It's perfect when I just have a little bit of downtime and I'm looking for something to kind of engage me. And I have fun doing it, which is the important thing. There's bright colors. It's a really cool visual design. And it's got cool little characters that I like. Best Fiends. It's a great game. Check it out for yourself. This is a 5-star rated game because of the characters, the fun and challenging puzzles, and, you know, the antagonists in this are slugs, Tim. And we've all got slugs in our world that irritate us, agitate us, and, you know, typically annoy us.
Oh, yes.
Here's your chance to defeat the slugs. Slugmageddon is one of my favorite moments, Tim, when I combine the right amount of force and blow them away. It sounds silly. It's fun, and silly design is what's going to keep you coming back to it time and time again. It's a unique, exciting puzzle experience, unlike other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. And Best Fiends treats the game like a service for their players. If you find yourself playing in random weird places, or you play at random times, talk about that with everybody else on Facebook. I'm on. You can actually link in. You can pass gifts to one another. And since I've joined, I have a lot of our listeners that will send me gifts. I've returned the favor and sent them gifts as well. You don't have to play this game alone. 100 million downloads globally. That's downloads. That's amazing. And it doesn't require internet to play. It's great for traveling. You can play anywhere, anytime, plane, subway, etc. This is a fun, breezy, engaging game. Try it out for yourself. Take it from somebody who does not jump on trends or takes a long time to get there. I'm glad I found it, and it is so much fun. Engage your brain with fun puzzles. Collect tons of cute and fun characters that are multi-powered. It's got a 5-star rated mobile game app on the Apple Play Store and in the Google Play Store as well. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play right now. That's Fiends. F-I-E-N-D-S, Best Fiends. Play it now. Have a great time. Join Tim and I in our adventure. And while you're out there, send us gifts. We need to get further in our game. You'll find us linked to our Facebook pages. That's the best way to have this game and share it with all of you. And it's a good way to compete. How about that, Tim? Let's compete with these listeners of ours.
I love it.
All right, check it out now. Best Fiends. You're going to be glad I told you about it. It's time to turn it up with your new favorite podcast, Expeditiously with T.I., here right on Podcast One. Join the rapper, entrepreneur, family man, and activist as he bridges the gap and sheds light on important social topics and much more in an authentic eyebrow-raising dialogue that might make you want to pull out your dictionary. Download new episodes of Expeditiously with T.I. every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader, who is in France, but will be back next weekend as we continue our journey into the strange and supernatural. We'll have supernatural news on Saturday, and again, another great guest on Sunday. Our guest today is Mike Perley. He has a brand new book out there called The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomena. And before the break, we told you we were going to jump into another phenomena, one that I wish I could enact, but Mike, I don't know, with all the stuff I have going on health-wise, I'd want to do this. Immortal humans actually living forever. I tell you, Mike, I'm so broken down right now. And when I say that, you know, a lot of us say, oh, I'm so broken down. Dude, I've got 13 herniated discs between my neck and my back. I've got severe arthritis all over my body. And now my ticker wants to do some stuff to me. Do I want to be immortal, first of all?
Well, you know, I think you do. I think you do. I kind of butted heads with some people at a few places in the editorial process when I was writing this chapter, because they kept saying, talk about why people wouldn't want to be immortal. Talk about why death is good. And I was just like, well, I don't know. I'd rather not die. I think it's okay to want to maybe, if not, it maybe not live forever. I'd love to live for 1,000 years instead of maybe 80. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
I think of it this way. Fun stuff is here in alive, and over there in dead, you know, there's nothing there. There's nothing to do. So I think, I don't know. I say in the book, I think it's okay to talk about wanting to be immortal, or to at least want to live a really, really long life. You know, give yourself permission. Give yourself permission to say, like, it'd be nice to live forever.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, because you kind of, when you say immortality on this side, you kind of, you know, you start to wander into people's spiritual beliefs too.
Sure. Sure. Sorry.
You know, no. And that's fine, that, you know, that because some people say, well, but, you know, the people who do tend to, you know, think, well, but I've got that beautiful stuff over on the other side, and why would I want to, you know, I want to go. I don't want to be here forever. But then, you know, I take the side of this, Mike, and that's this. I love my life. I love my life here, even though I do go through an incredibly tough physical time over here. I love every moment of my life. I love being around my family. I love being around my friends. I have a great time. I love to joke around. I love to make people happy. So I have a great time with life, even though there are extremely tough times in life, and we've all had them. If you don't have a positive attitude about stuff and don't have the will to want to overcome, yeah, life is tough. But if you have an attitude of, well, I'm going to knock the bad stuff over and I'm going to really enjoy the good stuff, you know, then yeah, life's a bitch, and you do want to get buried 6 feet under.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and to your point about people's spirituality, look, I think that people with real faith about the hereafter. Mm-hmm. I think that's a beautiful thing. I really think I applaud that. For when it comes to my own spiritual journey, which I won't get into,
yeah,
I have, you know, that I think, and I think probably with most people, there's at least a twinge of doubt that it's there, that, mm-hmm. that the afterlife is there. Even if you have faith, I think there's at least a twinge of doubt that it's there and that there's not just, you know, nothing. Mm-hmm. And so, it is with that in mind that I'm saying, like, we're talking about immortality in the here and now, in what we call, you know, meat space, the real, the world, you know, where you can feel the ground underneath your feet, the world we're in, that kind of immortality is what
right.
I'm talking
about. Right. Yeah. And, you know, there is something about being able to have the ground under your feet, to be able to feel the wind hit your face, to be able to hold the ones you love, to be able to experience something in the three-dimensional realm that feels good. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's just, let's just call it what it is. And I know that, you know, when we talk about that on a spiritual note here on this show, you know, we're told, well, this is meant to be a learning plane. This is kind of where we come to learn. And then, you know, you're off and back into the ether. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, could we make this a permanent thing? Could we build ourselves to make this a permanent thing? You know, people have one or two reactions. The first reaction is, yeah, I don't know that I'd want to do that. You know, if I start filleting pieces of myself and it becomes machinery, then I feel like I'm trapped in my body. Then I get that claustrophobic feeling. And the other is, hell yeah, dude, throw some mechanical crap on me and I'm good to go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious, Mike, what's your take on it? If someone were to say to Mike, you know what, Mike, if we throw a few mechanical parts to you, or if we could just take your head and put it on a robot body and dude, you're good for 1,000 years. What do you think?
I would probably, okay, here's what I'd say to that. I'd say, let me wear this body out first. You mm-hmm. know, let me get my mileage out of the one that I have. If I can, you know, if I can like hold off on installing spare parts and use my natural arms for the time being, get my use out of this thing and then switch over to the Android form. I think I would. I would say yes to that personally. But now, so, you know, I want to, can I go into a little bit of the,
yeah, please,
a few of the dilemmas that I found writing about this?
Sure, please.
So one of the big problems with writing about immortality is that you never look at your watch and go like, oh, I made it to forever. I'm immortal. I got, here I am in forever, because forever is never, forever doesn't come. Every day is just today. And eternity continues to stretch out in front of you. Mm-hmm. So immortality can, in a sense, never be achieved because you would only look at it subjectively from a fixed point in time. You could never assume that whatever immortality state you're in will just continue to stretch out infinitely in the future. So what I did was I consulted some statisticians. And this guy Brian Bischoff of this company called Quasi Coherent Labs, and I had him, you know, look into the math of immortality, which I couldn't find this anywhere online. And he said, "Well, here's how we can create some assumptions about immortality." He told me that. We'll probably know in terms of medical immortality, invulnerability, imperviousness to aging and that kind of thing, you'll never be able to be impervious to, you know, bullets and having an arrow put through your head or something like that. So even if immortality is achieved, invulnerability may never be achieved. So he told me that that when it comes to, so we're talking about the kind of immortality of a people like Aubrey de Grey, people who want to reverse aging,
okay,
if you will. So that's the sort of immortality we're talking about. And he said that where that stuff is concerned, that you can only be about as immortal as an 8-year-old child.
Hmm.
And I'll tell you what I mean by that.
Okay.
He said if you're an insurance company, 8-year-old children are about as close as you can get to immortality. kids, little kids from newborns to 7 years old are susceptible to some diseases, some forms of sudden death. And then kids from 9 onward just get more and more likely to die. But when you are right there at 8 years old, that is when you are, for all intents and purposes, invulnerable. you probably won't get any cancers or anything like that. You could, but you probably won't. So for the graphs in my book, the assumption of the invulnerability of an 8 year old is what informs what's called the Makem baseline in human statistics, and that's what I based my form of immortality on.
Okay.
So people immortal people in my world are just people who are going to live a very, very long time and aren't likely to get any diseases or anything like that. So basically, if you are an 8 year old in terms of your health, then he looked at the statistics about what insurance companies say is the likelihood of the death of an 8 year old, and in order to figure out how long you would live, in terms of how long you would avoid things like being hit by a car or falling off a cliff or having a building fall on you or something like that, and just in terms of if you were immortal, how long would you have to live before, you know, an accident happened that finally claimed your life? Mm-hmm. And he said you could go on for millions of years, but you probably wouldn't. You would probably, after about, statistically speaking, it works out to be actually about 1,000 years, something would happen to you. A flying car would hit you, an alien would shoot you with a laser or something like that. And you would finally expire, but not from some boring heart disease or cancer or something like that. You would finally get hit by a space trolley, basically.
What a horrible ending.
And that's unfortunately probably the closest we can get to immortality. Unless, as you were saying, we all get put into like robot bodies and stuff like that. Then we can carry on forever.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, when I just assumed we'd have to be transferred into a different body in order to manage to get to immortality. Either that or clones. I've seen too much Star Wars, the whole Clone War thing. I always assumed it'd be clones. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, you know, because I think It does seem like it's going that way, right? It does seem like yeah, some kind of android life or something like that is in the works. But when it comes to just simple anti-aging, that really seems like that is, you know, maybe closer to becoming a reality than people think. Mm-hmm. And so that same guy, Brian Bischoff, he pointed out to me what the consequences are of that kind of quote unquote immortality. And he said, so he basically measured the amount of space that it takes for a human to live, not the space that you live in, but the amount of space on Earth that you take up in terms of resources. And he estimated that out to be about an acre. And he said, you know, if every human uses an acre of space in order to live, you need an acre for farming, an acre for water, an acre for generating energy, mm-hmm, and an acre to sleep in and cook in and do your work in. He worked it out and figured out that we're in trouble.
Yeah.
We have maybe about 200 years, and then by then, all area on the first 5 planets and Neptune would be filled. And then after that, the other 3 planets would only take about another 100 years or so. So in a very short time, you know, in talking about galactic time here, in a very short timeline, if we're not dying, you know, if our lives cease to be as short as they currently are, we run into a real estate crisis, if you will, a bigger housing crisis than the one than the one that we currently have.
Jeez. That's, I mean, that when you think about that, that's the amount of space one person needs. That's extremely greedy.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of. So maybe immortality is not, you know, maybe there are some moral questions there to be discussed further. That's fortunately for me, I'm not an ethicist.
Well, you know, you start to think about it, and you know, there's the old Illuminati rule that they wanted to get the world down to 500,000 people. Maybe right. There is a reason for that. I mean, maybe they knew the entire time that, you know, the world could only hold so many people.
Yikes. Yeah. I mean, maybe they did. Maybe Thomas Malthus was right that, you know, that the contraction and expansion of humans is this natural phenomenon. I'm not sure. To me, I want everybody to live. I have an abiding love for people.
Yeah, so. I'm not trying to harsh anybody's gig or trying to kick anybody off the planet, but
sure.
Yeah, it's interesting that when you think about it, you know, that there's, yeah. It just takes an enormous amount of resources to keep one person going.
Yeah.
You never think of it that way. You know?
Yeah, to keep one person going and certainly to keep one very, very resource-hungry species going. Yep.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Okay, I want to transition into another topic that's in your book and one that's close to my heart because I have had, being a brittle diabetic, I have had quite a few run-ins with this. That's the day we run out of effective antibiotics.
Oh, yikes. Okay.
Yeah, this one's close to my heart here, Mike. I've actually, in my lifetime, in four separate occasions, had a doctor come to me in the middle of the night in my hospital bed and tell me where I was going to lose my right leg. Oof. And yeah.
You still have that leg?
I still do. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you. I have a I have a condition called Charcot foot, which is extremely rare and extremely French, much like me. But it's a diabetic condition, and I'll tell you just real quickly where your ankle bones go soft from neuropathy. So then the weight from that you put down on your leg bone drives your leg bone through your ankle and through your foot. Fun, huh?
That sounds pretty rough. Yeah.
It is, yeah. And so what they do is they put you on mass amounts of vitamin D to try and get everything to coagulate back together, your bones and everything, because it becomes soft like sand. And then from there, it's like stepping on glass on the bottom of your foot because, of course, your bones are jagged. Your arch becomes inverted. So it's like walking on a bowl of glass on the bottom of your foot.
Well, oh gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So they can do an operation where they flatten out the foot. Well, I tried to have that done, but my foot, the skin and muscle didn't want to come back together. So all kinds of different complications happened there, including multiple infections. So I've seen just about every antibiotic known to man, and I'm allergic to most sulfa-based antibiotics. So I've seen a lot of them that you probably never heard of in order to treat most people. So I'm interested in this scenario that you talk about in the book about what happens the day we run out of effective antibiotics. And I followed a lot of the stories in the media. And I think it's not a reality to a lot of people because a lot of people end up not taking antibiotics during the year unless they get something like, you know, a run of bronchitis or just a, you know, like a cold that's a little out of control. They might get a Z-Pak from their doctor or something, you know, that's maybe a little out of control for what they're dealing with at the time. And a Z-Pak's kind of like killing a fly with a sledgehammer. Not necessarily what you need at the time, but because you want to be satiated. For a little bit of discomfort, you're being given something that maybe you shouldn't be given at the time. You know, your body can probably fight through it. And so these superbugs are being built because you're using something probably you don't need at the time to get through what your illness. How close are we to running out of effective antibiotics right now?
We're somewhat scarily close to running out of antibiotics right now. You sound like quite an expert, actually. You've been through a lot of these. I was not able to get a time estimate. For a lot of these scenarios, I don't get a very specific time estimate, because I think that if you're in the business of predicting the timeline that things are going to happen on, mm-hmm. those are the future predictors who get in the most trouble and lose their credibility the fastest. So I try not to make too specific of time frame estimates for things like this. But I will say that we are at risk of a big outbreak of a major antibiotic resistant infection. And sometimes I don't think people realize just how many infectious diseases are caused by bacteria as mm-hmm. opposed to viruses. You know, for instance, I don't think people know that bubonic plague is a bacteria and not a virus. And I don't think people realize that you would almost say that most infections that people are getting lately, bacterial infections that people are subject to, are, you know, somewhat changed. Their evolutionary process has changed somewhat to help them get around our antibiotics. The whole world of bacteria, the ones that eat us, has been completely changed by our drugs for treating them. And, you know, we haven't seen a large scale, if you will, revenge of the bacteria. But I would say that it's definitely something that we'll see within our lifetimes for sure.
Which is scary in itself. I mean, it's not like we can just whip a new antibiotic out.
No, we can't. And since you've taken so many of them, I wonder if you've heard of one called fosfomycin.
Heard of it, but never taken it.
It's a pretty rare one. It's an example of an antibiotic that is out there that is, so in the case of fosfomycin, it's an antibiotic with a lot of side effects mm-hmm. that is, it's sort of after what are called the last antibiotics of last resort. And in the case of fosfomycin, it's extremely rare for it to be used as an injectable antibiotic, because there are already so many antibiotics that are much better, that work much better, that don't cause as much nausea and vomiting and, you know, potential devastating allergies and things like that. But, you know, if there's suddenly an outbreak of a bacteria that is resistant to something like another last resort antibiotic like vancomycin, then there'll suddenly be a market for these, you know, not so great antibiotics like fosfomycin that might not be very fun to take, but hey, we might not have a choice. And to make matters worse, they're not mass produced. They're not mass produced as injectable antibiotics, and they're very rare to be seen as oral antibiotics. And so then, so how are people going to get these drugs that aren't mass produced by big pharma? Well, I mean, how do people get any drugs that aren't mass produced by big pharma? They find a way. Yeah. Unfortunately. So I think that's kind of what we would, that's sort of, those are the kinds of things that we have to start thinking about when these outbreaks happen and then start to become common.
Yeah, vancomycin is one of the ones I can't take. It's
oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So I run into some hairy situations, especially what the operation that to flatten out my foot actually left an infection in the bone, and yeah, so it was touch and go for a bit, and they were looking for it. At first, they wanted to start a vancomycin drip, and they did initially as I was out of it. And I ended up getting sepsis from the infection in the bone.
Oh, no.
Because they had used a wound vac to close the foot, and it brought it into the bloodstream. And I came about 60 seconds within passing away from dying.
Oh, wow. So did your kidneys begin to fail?
Everything was starting to shut down. My blood pressure had gone down. My blood sugar was it wouldn't come back up, and they were starting to lose me in the hospital bed. I had two nurses working at me at the same time, and one was monitoring my blood pressure, the other was trying to keep my blood sugar up, and and they were afraid that the sepsis was spreading, was going to spread to my heart and scar my heart.
So I spoke to somebody. You'd have been a great interview subject for the book, because I spoke to I sought out people who had had experiences not unlike yours. You know, going through advanced sepsis is no picnic.
No,
and most people in your position, I'd say you're extremely lucky. From my research, it sounds like you're among the 1 in 5. Who get that far and survive, because they are fortunately usually able to find a working antibiotic that that works. And then they'll also in a situation like yours, they also do a lot of excising tissue. But it sounds like they didn't have to excise too much infected tissue in your case.
Nope.
Okay,
good. I had very good doctors at the University of Minnesota. They worked very quickly. They diagnosed it very quickly. They worked very quickly, and they actually didn't have to do very much at all. So,
I'm so glad to hear it. Yeah. Because like some of the more interesting experiences that sepsis victims go through, as it really begins to advance, is there's this extreme constriction of the blood vessels, mm-hmm. right, as organ failure begins, which was described by this guy Christian Armstrong that I spoke to. What he experienced when his blood vessels constricted was that his IVs shot out of his veins. They shot out and shot across the room because his blood vessels constricted so tight and so fast, which just sounds absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And then he said that they, in order to find a vein, they held him upside down. His veins were so thin, and it was so hard to find a place to insert an IV after that they had to hold him upside down so that his blood would run downhill, and only once they did that did his veins enlarge enough for them to inject him. And the really bad news in a world where there are no effective antibiotics is, you know, they won't be injecting you with antibiotics at that point. They'll be injecting you with morphine, because it's over.
Right.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it was a scary scenario. I know that much. I didn't want to know odds at that point. I knew the odds were 1 in 5 at that point. But I didn't. I was like Han Solo. I didn't want to know the odds at that point. I just knew.
I mean, it sounds incredible. It's that, yeah. That is quite a story.
Yeah.
You know, but one thing I want to say about antibiotics is that you know, we've been fighting this battle against bacteria since, you know, the big coming out party for antibiotics was World War II. Mm-hmm. And you know, since that happened, we've kind of become way too accustomed to things like just taking a course of antibiotics. Like you were saying, when you get an infection, you say you have an STD infection, mm-hmm. you have chlamydia or something like that. And doctors are pretty much accustomed to just saying, oh, but we'll just give you a course of antibiotics and you'll be fine. And those days might soon be over. We are starting to see, as horrible as this phrase is, antibiotic resistant sexually transmitted infections.
Ooh, wow.
But what that means is that our other means of fighting bacteria have to come into effect. And in the case of sexually transmitted diseases, we have things like condoms, you know, which are unfortunately pretty underused. Mm-hmm. And people don't use them for a variety of reasons. One of which is maybe they don't think about, they think about them in terms of fighting pregnancy, and they think about them in terms of fighting, maybe HIV, and maybe they aren't sufficiently afraid of HIV. But that's going to change. That's going to change when public health notices come out that say, hey, you need to be worried about antibiotic resistant clap that's not going away once you get it. When those days come back, I think that some of our non-drug antibacteria technologies will come back in vogue, as it will. And I know that doesn't sound like good news, so I'll put it in a different context.
Sure.
In 1994, in the city of Surat, India, there was an outbreak of bubonic plague. And, you know, a few dozen people died. I'm sorry, it actually wasn't bubonic plague. It was worse. It was pneumonic plague, which, unlike bubonic plague, is spread by coughing. You can cough. You can just cough and give somebody the plague. Yeah. Very, very bad stuff. So, you know, what's sort of miraculous about this particular outbreak is that the number of people who died was less than would fit on a British double-decker bus. Even though it was an outbreak of an extremely contagious form of an extremely deadly disease in a country that is, I think, thought of here in the West as a place where there are a lot of easy disease vectors. And so I went there to talk to their public officials about what happened. And and what I found when I was there, oh, it sounds like I have the pneumonic plague. Sorry about that. What I found when I was there was a collection of officials who were, as crazy as this sounds, extremely ready for an outbreak of plague. They were really on the ball. I watched their plague monitoring system, and it consists of, it's very low tech. It consists of trapping rats, counting the number of fleas on each rat, testing them for plague, which they hadn't, fortunately, when I was there, they weren't finding any. And then when the number of fleas elevates to a certain point, then it's sort of viewed as a little, the flea situation is out of control. And they strategically spread a very cheap pesticide called malathion around the city of Surat. They do this in several cities in India. And that keeps the fleas down. And they have not seen an instance, even in a rodent, of plague since 1994. So, you know, they're using public resources in an extremely smart way to stop the spread of what could be a totally devastating bacterial infection. And that just goes to show that, you know, we sometimes talk about the spread of antibiotic-resistant contagious diseases as though they're going to be the apocalypse, and I'll tell you, and they're not going to be good. It's not going to be good when there's an outbreak of an antibiotic-resistant, a major antibiotic-resistant disease. But it probably won't be the apocalypse because we know now, as humans, that these things are scary. We know to do simple things like cover our faces, which was something that saved a lot of lives in India that year. Simply people doing something as silly as pulling their shirt over their mouth when they knew that they were around an area that had plague there.
Yep.
Just pulling their shirt over their mouth to breathe saved lives. Just simply doing that. Which isn't to say that we don't need bacteria, that we don't need antibiotics. It's just to say that at least we understand how these diseases spread. And that really, you know, makes a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Let's take a small break here, and just for this message, another way you can learn little things about health, Pluto TV. They have plenty of channels to teach you about health as well. They're the leading free streaming television service. Watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. Pluto TV never asks for a credit card. You don't even need to sign up to watch for free. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies for free. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. You can download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, including your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smart TVs, PlayStation, and anywhere else you stream. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Our guest is Mike Pearl. The book is The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, is Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomenon. You know, Mike, one of the nightmare scenarios when I was young way back in the 1940s. I'm kidding. Actually, when I was younger in the 80s, was the scenario of nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had the day after, the movie The Day After on ABC, and we had we just had the bejesus scared out of us when it came to scenarios of nuclear war with the Soviets and America, and that died down for quite a while. And then it seems like lately, with the threat of North Korea, that threat is slowly starting to come back. And you have a chapter in your book dealing with the day nuclear war occurs. Is this a real threat, first of all? And second, will that threat always continue to hang over us?
The threat is unfortunately very much real. Not only that, but since, you know, there was that pause after the 80s, mm-hmm. where it felt like it went away, it didn't go away. It was there the whole time. But yeah, the threat of nuclear war, as long as nuclear weapons continue to exist, is going to be kind of an existential threat for humans, unfortunately. And I would say that right now we are once again very much on the brink of that threat. We're about as things are about as scary in terms of nuclear war as they've ever been, as a matter of fact. So yeah, that is unfortunately one of the more realistic and plausible scenarios in the book,
which is absolutely terrifying. I guess not only for myself, but for you know, my nephews and for future generations. I don't look forward to those days. The fact that you know, especially with our government's playing fast and loose with weapons like that, it is absolutely terrifying. So what happens in today's modern scenario with nuclear war? Because I mean, the players that are involved in what exactly would happen, but in a scenario where, like, let's say North Korea decides they want to feel frisky and fire one over in our direction, is it the same scenario where we essentially bomb each other into out of existence, or what are we looking at in that scenario?
Well, you know, what I discovered while I was researching this book is that our kind of inability to conceive of what would happen in the event that a nuclear strike actually occurred, mm-hmm. is of strategic importance to the nuclear powers. If you have nuclear weapons in your possession, then you have, in a sense, the means to bring about doomsday. And there's a real sense in which the threat that you'll extinct all of humans has to be on the table in order for your nuclear weapons to. If you say I'll never push the button, I'll never extinct all of humanity, I just simply won't do it, then your deterrent's not working. Somebody has to believe you're crazy enough to do it. Not everybody necessarily will. And so you were talking about North Korea in this instance.
Yep.
And we know about how powerful their biggest warheads are from their most recent and largest tests. And we can guess that they could, you know, we know they have, we know from their arcing intercontinental ballistic missile tests that went way, way, way up high and then dropped down into the sea, that they can plausibly hit United States soil. Now those missiles might not be perfect. They might not be in perfect shape. They haven't demonstrated that there are capabilities that they haven't, you know, fully demonstrated that, for instance, everything will go perfectly according to plan, that their missiles will exit the atmosphere and re-enter and be perfectly targeted. But we can assume that they might. They might. They've made it clear that those are all possibilities, mm-hmm. for the technology that we've seen that they have. The question then becomes, would we do it? Would we retaliate? And how much? And we're not allowed to know is the thing. The president's nuclear football, as they call it, a nuclear strike is referred to as Operation Kickoff. And I'm sorry, Operation Dropkick. And so the president's nuclear football is a pun about Operation Dropkick, a very unfunny pun, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the event that we're bombed, then the football gets opened up. President opens up that sleeve and it says, oh, did they just bomb Hickam Field in Hawaii? Well, then in that case, here's where our current warheads are. Here's the missiles that they're attached to. Here's who they should target. And here's how many we should launch. And they just say, well, do we do it or do we not? And we have no idea what those orders are. It might be that that if there were one nuclear strike on U.S. soil, that we would say, OK, do it. Drop 50 nuclear warheads on North Korea. Annihilate the entire country, you know, but we don't know if that's what we would do. And in fact, I think a lot of analysts think that's not too likely because strategically it's in many ways not that smart to do it that way. We can't guarantee that even an immense, downright genocidal nuclear strike on North Korea would completely neutralize them. We don't know if that's true. We assume that it would. It's a lot of nuclear weapons, but we know that they'd be underground in bunkers. We might drop everything we have on them and not completely neutralize the nuclear threat. And then what do we do? So what I discovered as I was researching this was that there's this strange balance. We do have the capability to launch enough nuclear weapons between all of the nuclear powers. We definitely have the capability to launch enough nuclear weapons to kill everyone, basically. Mm-hmm. But would we? Does it even make any strategic sense? Is massive retaliation a sensible strategy in circumstances like this? And it's not clear at all. It's just a big mystery. We could, but the question of would we is not within my capabilities to answer, basically.
It's a scary scenario. I mean, the thought that just us alone, just our firepower alone is enough to take out the entire world if we wanted to. Russia's sitting on enough to take out the entire world if they wanted to. Now you have North Korea, who has a fairly nice stock sitting where they're sitting.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're not going to take out the world, but they have enough to get some stuff started. You know, and you have other you have Iran who's building up their cash. So, you know, you have other, I guess, what we considered third world countries in the past that are building up their arsenals. And it seems like it's easier and easier to get a hold of nuclear weapons now, which in itself is a scary prospect. I don't know that in this day and age, you know, that this is a weapon that we should be playing with. It was bad enough when the Soviets and the U.S. had them and we were stockpiling them in record numbers. And it's not exactly an easy weapon to just take apart and throw away.
No, certainly not. Yeah. And the trouble, of course, is that we are is that, you know, our leadership here is talking about building new ones. After all this time, after all of the nuclear treaties and the discussion of disarming, now we're talking about further armament against all odds. You know, sort of never thought I'd see the day, but here we are.
Yeah, here we are indeed. Here we are indeed. I guess with that, there are other scenarios here in this book that you do tackle. One of the last ones that I want to talk about, and it's kind of one of those ones we've seen in movies before, but I absolutely have to tackle it with you because this is one of the movies that one of the movie franchises I've always looked at and shook my head at. And I do have to tackle it with you here, Mike. Dinosaur Parks. Of all the attractions I would never take a kid to, a dinosaur park would be one of them. You know, when I sit and watch Jurassic Park, I scratch my head and I think, of all the unsafe places you would ever take a kid to, that would be like, hey, Billy, do you want to go chainsaw juggling, fire breathing, or go to a dinosaur park? Because either way, you're not coming out with all your limbs, you know?
Right, sure, sure.
You know, I mean, I don't know if Steven Spielberg put a lot of thought into that before he went to make the movie, but to me, it just made, I guess there's common sense there, you know, that something was bound to go wrong, you know? That's like saying, Mommy, I'm bringing Godzilla home for a pet. you know, it's bound to go wrong, you know? It's like the joke writes itself type of scenario. I gotta ask, first of all, as you're going to write about dinosaur parks in the book, did you kind of know you were setting yourself up in that chapter?
Well, you know, I it was one that I really wanted to go into with an open mind. What sort of put me in mind of Jurassic Park was, have you ever, did you read a couple of years ago the news about Fyre Festival?
Yes. Yeah.
So Fyre Festival put me in mind of Jurassic Park. Here was a rich guy, inviting a bunch of rich people like himself out to an island to have some fun that he had not really prepared his island for, and disaster struck because he didn't know what he was doing. Basically,
right.
There were nobody got eaten by any dinosaurs. That was the missing ingredient. But you know, in my brain, I kind of filled in the gaps. So I thought, like, oh, this is, you know what? As technology increases, maybe this Jurassic Park thing is something we should actually take seriously. That was kind of my reason for taking on the topic.
I'm sure there are a few people who were wanting cheese sandwiches and water that were wanting to be eaten by dinosaurs.
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
at that point,
So basically, I set about, you know, you're talking about the inevitability of things going wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what the original book, that's what Michael Crichton's book Jurassic Park is about, the inevitability of things going wrong. He invents a character named Ian Malcolm, who's this, you know, expert in what's called chaos theory. And Ian Malcolm is based on this guy, James York, the mathematician and physicist. And that was the guy who coined the term chaos as a sort of in a mathematical context, along with this other mathematician named Tianyan Li. So I got a hold of him. I got a hold of York, and I said, you know, how certain is it that a dinosaur island would be a disaster? How, you know, do we actually know that it would necessarily be a disaster? And what York basically said was, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be a disaster. He said, just look at any amusement park or any zoo, and you'd see that any amusement park or zoo would be a disaster if you didn't have planning and plan and backup plans, and you didn't do everything that you could to figure out, you know, you have to, in the case of a Jurassic Park, you have to beta test. You have to see those dinosaurs on that island go berserk once, and then, but in a controlled way, and then put them back into place. So I kind of, like, you know, it was a strange sort of way to try and comfort me, but I kind of saw his point. You know, when I was at, I went to Six Flags not long after that.
Mm-hmm.
and I was on a roller coaster, and down sitting out in a dirt clearing, when the roller coaster was stopped, I could see a little dirt clearing, and in the dirt clearing there were a bunch of mannequins that were, the mannequins were basically jugs full of water, and they were right next to an area where they could be just like plunked into the seats in the roller coaster where I was sitting. And it made me think of Jurassic Park. I looked at those jugs of water and I thought, that's me. And when they were testing this roller coaster, they stuck that jug of water in place of me and let it go around the track a few times because they must have tweaked something. And if that jug of water falls out, or that jug of water gets hit by a plank at 60 miles an hour, then they know not to let people on. And they've only let me onto this roller coaster because the jug of water survived. And, you know, and I, a very different jug full of a very different liquid, I'm probably gonna make it around this roller coaster safely. So it's only in those terms that you can kind of think about Jurassic Park, something that you could, like you said, take kids to, because, like, you know, statistically, things do go wrong. Amusement parks do break down, and in the world of a Jurassic Park, dinosaur rampages would occasionally happen, much like you see with, like, Harambe I forget which zoo that was. I think it was in Ohio.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, that was very much a Jurassic Park like situation. You know, that's a zoo basically, and you know, if that was a velociraptor instead of a gorilla, then people would be grieving the loss of a dead velociraptor. But you know, in that case, it was just a gorilla. So, I mean, Jurassic Park is a zoo.
Yeah.
Would zoo rampages happen if it was a dinosaur zoo? Yeah. From time to time, they clearly would. But it might also be fun. you just have to do the mental arithmetic in your head to figure out if it's worth it or not.
Zoo rampages might be fun. That's very punk rock of you, Mike. I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Get a little dinosaur mosh pit going. We'll
right.
We'll have the Cramps play. It'll be fun. That's a good way to end it, I think. A dinosaur zoo mosh pit. That actually would be a great name for a punk band. I like that. All right. Well, if by all means, we encourage people, pick up the book, The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, Immortal Humans, and Other Possible Phenomena. We've only scratched the surface today of everything that's in the book. There's lots of good stuff in there. The inspiration for the book was, Mike's popular, Vice column, How Scared Should I Be? And lots of good stuff in there, including the loss of the world's marine life, a lot of the stuff that we talked about today, the ban on guns in the U.S., even the arrival of aliens, and reports back from the future, providing a clear picture of how the world would look, feel, and even smell in each of these instances. It's a pretty comprehensive book, and it's got some great stuff in it. Again, it's available on Amazon.com. Go check it out right now. We'll have a link to that book in the description of this show. Mike, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This was very fun.
All right. And we had a great time. Me, myself, and I and all my personalities had a great time talking with you as well. That sounded very awkward, didn't it, Mike?
No, it was fine.
Yeah, I had a great time as well. So thank you very much, Mike. Thank you all for joining us this weekend. And again, want to thank Mally Fox for joining us on Sunday for Supernatural News. Had a great time with her. Be sure to check out on YouTube, On the Rocks Radio. On the Rocks with Mally Fox. Her podcast will be coming out soon, her second episode. Check her out at YouTube for On the Rocks with Mally Fox. And we want to thank Mike as well for being on today. Dave Schrader will be back next week. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you again for joining us this weekend for the best in paranormal talk radio. This has been Beyond the Darkness.